Let the mind be very restful. Unconcerned. And in the state of a little calmness, let us recall again that if we are seriously concerned with religion in its depth, we must realize that we as we are not yet fully human. We are growing towards the full stature of humanity. And from the religious point of view, in this growth, we have to learn to let the psychophysical organism, as it now is, become pure and sensitive to the influence of all the archetypal forces, the realm of Akasha. Let us also bear in mind that this cannot be regarded as a goal, an end of the journey, something to be attained or achieved. Because by the time the psychophysical organism is the pure and sensitive receiver of the akashic forces, all selfness is out. Only the separate self can attain and achieve. He who has realized full humanity is no longer a separate self, but purely a center through whom these deep forces enter and radiate out again. Now, in order that the psychophysical organism, commonly called myself, may become such a center, all religions have taught the basic necessity for the moralities. And the great objective of the moralities is to convert this psychophysical organism into a pure organism, pure physically, pure psychically, pure in mind. And in that purity will be associated complete simplicity, complete openness of mind, a state of innocence, like the innocence of the child, but free from the child's state of ignorance. This is the extraordinary thing that does happen. Why did the great teachers stress, emphasize so strongly the necessity for the moralities? Because unless there is this purification, this utter simplification, this straightening out of the tangled mind, it is quite impossible to be mindful in the right sense, to use the senses in the right way. What we see, what we hear, we will always misinterpret because the observer is tainted with his greeds, his resentments, his frustrations, his ambitions, his envies, his grasping and all the rest of it. That is why. Also, there is no such thing as that strong, peaceful happiness possible in our lives, minus the moralities. One looks around in the world and says, oh, but look, the people who strive to live the good life are those who suffer most. In a sense, yes. But in the sense which is so important for us as human beings, the very reverse is the case. Because when the psyche is pure and clean and simple, it is calm and strong from within. Nothing can assail it. My enemy can slay my body. He cannot touch the soul. That is the point. And so there is this extraordinary inner strength, this natural power of purity which comes up from the soul, which is the real meaning of virtue, soul strength. The healthy soul is the strong soul, which means the virtuous soul. Just naturally virtuous. Just as it is perfectly natural for a healthy man to walk or run quite freely and easily. The body just naturally does it. That's that. Now we must appreciate that the moralities are something which we ourselves see as morality, as, let us use other words, pure, simple, innocent living. We ourselves must see that. If we try to conform to the verbal instructions of another, we will always be caught up in this difficulty. My interpretation of the other person's verbal instructions will be colored by my greeds and hates and all the rest of it. What I myself see as being free of ambition, envy, resentment, egoism, vanity, and all the rest of it, what I myself see as all that is the thing I can put into practice effectively. And more than effectively, naturally. It's second nature. When it is second nature, there is no calculation about it. There is no sense of, I ought to so and so. And if there is none of that, I am free from self-praise. I can't help it, it just happens that way with me. And I'm also free from a guilt complex, from any anxiety which questions, oh, have I done the right thing? Have I not done the right thing? That anxiety is due primarily to the fact that I'm self-concerned. Have I done the right thing or the wrong thing? Because I want the good results of the right and want to avoid the unpleasant results of the wrong. So all calculation is out. And when that sort of calculation is out, one is in tune with life and the nature of life, which is universal. It is a uniform which includes the totality of the multiform. This is the extraordinary part of it, hence its richness. It's uniform in the sense that it is pure through and through. And it's multiform in this sense that it expresses itself in multitudinous ways. And therefore it is wonderful. But just try and feel what this means in terms of inward calm and happiness. There is a peace and a joy which is like a radiating sun in the midst of circumstances which are full of stress and sorrow and gloom and all the rest of it. Now, it is essential for the psyche, our whole psychophysical organism, to realize this calmness. Calm as a lake is the phrase which is used, not only in Tibetan Buddhism particularly, but I think it comes again and again in Tibetan Buddhism, calm as a lake where the mind is concerned. But it is a phrase which has also been used by a very distinguished modern biologist, I've forgotten his name for the moment, who, researching along these lines, has said something to this effect, that when all this part of the brain, the midbrain and the hindbrain and so forth, are all calm as a lake, then the frontal brain shows, according to the encephalograph, perfectly rhythmic ripples. The function of the frontal part of the brain is still very much a matter of investigation. What we do know is that it deals with the deepest aspect of our mental life, the profoundest aspects. That's all we know about it so far. Now, it may be a matter of interest to you to consider, in connection with this, what was taught in the Rig Veda, and from the days of the Rig Veda onwards. They described the universe in various ways. One way is particularly interesting. You find this again and again in the Rig Veda. Heaven consists of two halves joined together, like two cups facing each other. They divided up the universe into Vyoman, heaven, Antariksha, the mid-region, and Prithvi, earth. Brahman, the supreme, the ultimate, has his footing in Prithvi, in earth. Out of earth grows the mid-region, Antariksha. And Vyoman governs the two, ultimately, heaven. Now, if you look at so many passages of the Rig Veda, you can see a very interesting, fanciful if you like, but an interesting relationship. The frontal brain, the midbrain, and the spinal cord. The spinal cord is earth. The body is earth. Earth is the common representative word of physical manifestation. And where the human being is concerned, it is his body. And primarily, his spine and the nerves that radiate out from the spine. Here is the part of the brain where all the senses, sense impressions take place and all the disturbances take place. Here is the still, silent part, the depths, the unruffled depths. When this is calm as a lake, then that functions. Take it in the terminology we have been using for some time. Transcendence, pure mind, and the natural order, the universe. The universe which is the individual man. It's interesting. But you see, the fundamentally important point is this. When this is calm, quiet, pure, then this, the whole universe, the individual man, is entirely healthy, functioning perfectly. And the profoundest aspects of him are in harmonious relationship with this, the manifesting universe. God and man are in harmony, so to say. Again and again, the moralities and their significance. Virtue and its significance. The senses have to be well trained. They have to be pure. And they have to be calm. If they are pure and calm, and if anyone is so supremely fortunate as to have the right sort of upbringing and education from childhood onwards, then that child will grow to full, balanced egohood. True individuality will blossom out in that child. And it is absolutely indispensable for full egohood to blossom out first, because unless it blossoms out in the right way, of course, therefore, that person can never be the selfless self, which is that pure nexus through which transcendent energy flows in and out unresisting and freely. You see the implications of all these things. Man's destiny is something unspeakably wonderful. Something like this, so it seems to me, is slowly trying to emerge, trying to take place. And as we have seen before, nature has done her task. The next steps forward with the power of nature behind it all depend upon our intelligent cooperation, because the element that we can bring into nature's work is the element of withinness, of the capacity to look within and make the right response. And the right response can only come if there is no grasping, if there is complete freedom of mind from within. That unshakable freedom of mind that the Buddha talked of, which is nirvana, the nirvanic state. As and when humanity reaches that nirvanic state, if it ever does, but we may hope so, we can only contribute to it. If it does, then nature will surely throw out a new kind of creature on this planet, who will be, as they put it in the old days, gods shall walk the earth again. These are not fanciful, wishful thinkings, thoughts, fanciful, wishful thoughts. One can see a trend. which may be interpreted somewhat along these lines. So you see what religion means and implies. And see how completely dependent it is upon the individual being moral. When you and I are true individuals in that sense, we are fully blossomed egos who live an egoless life. Egoless in the sense of unegoistic, because of relationship. It is quite impossible to play at living like an egoless being. You merely are a bit of jellyfish if you try to do that. You have to be the full ego, the I am, the limited I am. But because of intelligence, because of pure morality, that pure I am within this limited sphere also knows in his inner consciousness, is fully awake in his inner consciousness to the one and only I am, which is the total universe. And then there is at last right relationship. And the whole effort of nature, of all the universal forces, have come to perfect fruition in man. At last, nature has succeeded in making man, just as she succeeds in making beauty in plants and so forth and all the rest of it. Now consider one other point. Hundreds of millions of years ago, the plants, as they evolved, may have produced what nature finally produced in the animals, and particularly in man. Plants may have developed a nervous system and a brain, but they didn't. You know, in the early part of this century, that Indian scientist Sir P.C. Rai purported to show with his experiments that plants do have a nervous system, the mimosa plant's sensitivity and all the rest of it and so forth. But it has now been established that is incorrect. Plants do not have a nervous system in the real sense of the word. Had they been able to develop this nervous system, they could have developed brain and so forth. Why did the plants fail to develop a nervous system? It seems, and this is not, this is said by quite an eminent authority. It seems that they failed to develop the nervous system because in the helter-skelter of the struggle to survive, they indulged ad libitum sexually in order to preserve the species. Propagated absolutely wildly. Now, the development of a nervous system depends very considerably upon the power to delay responses and to make decisions. Which way shall I respond? Thus or thus or thus to this particular stimulus. This is the crucial factor. The plants did show such signs way back right back in the early stages, very early stages of elementary plant life. But somehow it didn't proceed as perhaps it should have proceeded. And in order to survive, they indulge themselves tremendously. Just ad libitum. And this prevented the development of the nervous system and a brain. Because one of the fundamental manifestations of brain is choice. I shall do so and so, or I shall do so and so, given the alternatives. A choice is made. Later on, there came the animals and, of course, man. And man displays that, and in man, of course, the brain is developed as in no other creature on this planet anyway. And you see the significance of it. Indiscriminate sense indulgence. And all sense indulgence is indiscriminate. The right use and the right expression of the senses is essential. But this indulgence is the force that prevents the flowering of the psychophysical being and the emergence of this extraordinary intelligence, which is quite other than the ordinary intellectual part of our life. This deep, unerring insight into the truth of things, whatever they are, whether they are material or psychological or transcendental, whatever they are, this unerring insight, this being at one with them, in tune with them all the time, not just as fixed ideas, but as continuous perception and action simultaneously. This is the important point. That is prevented through sense indulgence. So you see the enormous significance of the teachings in all the religions, not to give way to sense indulgence. Now, you know, the last two meetings, the last meeting we considered this question of sense indulgence, and the previous one this question of harmlessness as basic moralities. I would like, if I may, to put a question. I don't want you to all to blurt out the answer. But just let the mind quietly dwell upon this. If I am truly harmless, if I am truly harmless, can I be harmed? Apart from physically, of course. Sinner and saint alike have the same fate if a bus runs over them. But apart from physically, if I am truly harmless, can I be harmed? Just dwell upon that. What do you feel? Can you be harmed if you are truly harmless? It's perfectly so. You cannot be harmed if you are truly harmless. As I say, apart from physically. If I am truly harmless, then there is nothing in me which will react with violence, psychologically particularly, in my mind and heart. There is nothing in me which will react with violence against any stimulus whatsoever. And if I am truly harmless, then I am utterly free of deriving pleasure from inflicting harm on others or expressing my ego, my sense of power or superiority. Completely free of that. But this is a state of true egolessness, is it not? And under those circumstances, the psychophysical being here and now, John Smith, as he walks about, moves about, is a focus point for the inflow of transcendence and its free outflow in harmonious terms. And this is one of the deep meanings of love. Nothing sentimental about it. Nothing which is attached. Nothing which has anything to do with gratification of the senses. If I can be truly like that, I can never suffer from the sense of being unloved, unwanted. Which of us here has not suffered from that sometime or other in our lives? But you see, here is the secret, isn't it? Here is the immortal resolution of a mortal disharmony. If I am truly harmless. And does this not tie up with the fact that if I am quite free from sense indulgence, that is the right foundation for true harmlessness. What is it that produces the passion to react with violence, the frustration of sense indulgence? You think it out carefully. You examine it day and night, every day, and you will find that every single split second of our lives, this is true. This is constantly happening. Sense indulgence. And remember, last time when we considered this matter, we saw that the word sense is not to be confined just to the five so-called physical senses, but also to thought and feeling. Mind, the Indians have always said, is the sixth sense we have. Not sixth sense in the sense of clairvoyance or something like that, but just like seeing, hearing, touching, tasting and so forth. Our feelings, our thoughts. Mind is the sixth sense. All our cultural pursuits, all our intellectual acquisitions and so forth, which we want to accumulate. This is grasping, this is sense indulgence. See, you look at a Buddha Rupa. See the extraordinary calm, the extraordinary impression of being which is also non-being simultaneously present in that face. There is a person there who is completely egoless. Just consider that Buddha Rupa, that face, that superhuman calm and peace, the extraordinary depth and the wisdom. That infinite love which is utterly beyond what we, in our state of disturbance and turmoil, can never know. But in the calm it will come. When the senses are quiet, and the senses include the mind, this discursive talking mind, when that discursive talking mind is quiet, then that calm, that peace, and with it the power and impress of the archetypal realms comes through the whole psychophysical being. But to take that charge, like a condenser taking an electric charge, being filled with electric energy, to take that without breaking, without the apparatus breaking under it, there must be purity, utter purity. Because this purity means emptiness. The emptiness whose measure, if I may use that word measure in this context, is the fullness, the plenitude of the dimensionless, of the immeasurable akasha. These are extraordinary things, and only in man on this planet they come out, they flower out. It is not given even to the angelic orders to realize these things. Because they have no struggle to realize purity. And therefore to have the in and out sensitivity, the sensitivity which will let the inflow of transcendence and also allow its outflow. They haven't got it. You and I have that potentiality. Now look, if one sees this, one is aware of it with one's whole being, then there is freedom from the desire, the urge, to attempt to solve problems here. Do think about this very carefully, attend very carefully. Why do we all want to solve the problems which arise here in this limited sphere of duality? Because there is a separate, self-conscious, and isolated ego who is up against the environment. And he forms a picture in his mind of what the situation ought to be. And he struggles to bring it about. If he succeeds, for a time he's happy, and then something else happens, and once again he has to struggle. If he fails, he's also miserable. Miserable both ways. But But if you grow into the awareness, the sensitivity to this tremendous transcendent process, which is slowly, inevitably, surely fulfilling itself through time. The timeless can function and fulfill itself only through time and the becoming process. If you grow into that awareness, what is your stance, your attitude, your relationship towards worldliness and the worldly problems? It is one of full attention without any sort of grasping or illusion. And then the resolution of the whole discord emerges in the right way, out of the total environment which includes you yourself, and you yourself happen to be the pure central shining point, the focus point through which the transcendence works and brings its own resolution. Thy will, O Lord, not mine, be done. We talk of omnipresence. How little we know it. But what an overwhelming reality it is. And though overwhelming, it doesn't sweep you away and drown you in the flood. It sustains you completely. It fills you with its invincible strength. If you really see it. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune are like the petty little weapons of the Lilliputians against Gulliver. Then. And what's more, one doesn't resist the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. There comes up to my mind suddenly a story. I'm afraid it's slightly hazy in its outline, but you'll get the point. A devotee went to a great sage for spiritual instruction. His heart was really full of love and devotion. The sage happened to kick this devotee hard in the chest. And the devotee immediately put his hands and gently massaged the foot that kicked him and said, "I hope your foot has not been hurt." What an extraordinary story. But how true to religious reality. This is the point, isn't it? And you see, if you see this sort of thing, is there any door of the kingdom of happiness which closes upon you then? None at all. I was talking a little while ago about that face of the Buddha. This extraordinary freedom from the conflict of that duality, pleasure-pain, is on that face. And it is there on that face because there was a person who was utterly pure, utterly free of every sense indulgence, but whose senses were completely and totally alert, all his senses, so that he could say quite truly, a being not liable to delusion has arisen in the world. Is this not happiness? Is this not nirvana? And you see where it starts? It starts in earth, prithvi, the spinal cord, which all the nerves going out. And our ordinary psyche of the psychophysical organism functions there in the head, sends its impulses, the nervous impulses. And what comes back? There is that in the brain itself. Because of which we are self-conscious and make our decisions. And what is the art of making those decisions without grasping? Without greed, without resentment. And this is the way of transformation of the being. This religious life is something which transforms the whole being, not merely the mind and the heart of the man. That is its key point, so to say. Because man is man essentially insofar as he thinks and feels. Do not think this is old-fashioned fuddy-duddy goody-goodiness. If it is, let us bless our stars that there is at least one person who will stand up for it. Because this is the way of redemption and salvation. The other way, being with it, is the way of misery, decrepitude, and death, ultimately. The wrong sort of death. The death which is nature's pushing aside of a failure. Now, let us consider one other point, aspect of this thing. The subtleness with which we get trapped all along the line. One has to be gallant and gay in this adventure of the religious life. Have a strong sense of humor to sustain us so that we can laugh at ourselves very quietly. At all our failures, that is. But all along the line we fail. Suddenly, in the unawake moment, we are caught and there is the reaction of violence. The whole conflict of ought and ought not is a conflict born of sense indulgence. It is an indulgence of our sixth sense, the discursive mind, which has been conditioned in so many ways. Life ought to be like this, justice ought to be like that, the organization ought to run like this, the disciple ought to behave like that, the teacher ought to be on his pedestal on which I put him, and so forth and so forth. You see, it's the result of that kind of conditioning. So now, be intensely watchful. The play of the senses all the time. No repression of the senses, no fooling of oneself. You see exactly what you see, hear exactly what you hear. Don't build up illusions about it, and so forth. Neither indulge it nor repress it. This is the problem. This is the individual problem. No one can help you there. And this problem needs, as Krishnamurti says, for instance, extraordinary energy. Precisely that was said by the Buddha. It needs virya. Summon up this energy. This is determination, this is will, which is not a fixating power, but a liberating power. Not the will which will throw itself in opposition to something, but the will which enables attention to be so focused, so purely, so calmly, that resolution by transcendence of the disharmony takes place. That means that my mind, my brain, must never predetermine the shape which ought to emerge. These are difficult things, of course. The religious life is the most difficult thing to carry out. In the real sense, the religious life, in the ordinary sense, the external sense, well, it's quite a simple matter. You've only got to have a bath and put on the right dress and light a few candles or joss sticks and we all go through the motions and maybe eat and drink a little bit. After, just as we eat and drink a little bit before, and then we go home feeling very nice, beautifully preened. It's all very nice. Enjoy it. Why not? Go and enjoy it. It has its place, mind you. I have to start as a child, as an infant. I have to become the ordinary child, the adolescent. Grow into manhood, develop full egohood, my rights, my privileges, my ideas, all full of idealism and a grand will to break up the old world order because, oh, I don't know. That's where the full stop comes. But that's all inevitable. That happens. Now, let us spend just a few minutes . Every one of us has his or her own special ways of sense gratification. Sense of sight, sense of touch, sense of hearing. The activity of the discursive mind, the aesthetic and intellectual and all the other sides of our nature and so forth. We all have that. Now, let us look. In some of us it may be that one special way of sense gratification dominates all the others, or it may not. Let us just quietly look at the one or two which are outstanding ways. Without remorse, without regrets, without a guilt conscience about it, without any sense of, oh, I must get rid of this, because that is the way to keep it with me always. Just look at it very quietly, peacefully, calmly. Notice what an immense amount of psychical and physical energy went in this direction. Mostly squandered. Vainly squandered, believing that this is a way of happiness. It brought temporary pleasure, perhaps. Just look at it quietly. Look at the outstanding longings. The planning associated with them. The action. The frustrations. The thirst for repeating it over and over again. If successful, the thirst to try again and again to win the goal, the desired objective. The passion, the misdirected, misspent passion involved in it. And this energy, in its consummation, in its perfection and purity, is what theologians have called, without understanding the phrase themselves, the divine will. This energy. Look at it quietly. Understand it. Look with a compassionate eye, but not an indulgent eye. Because the indulgent eye is untruthful. The compassionate eye is truthful and it heals. Therefore, look that way, calmly, very calmly. And if we look at it very calmly, we'll get free of so many illusions associated with the desire for self-indulgence, for sense gratification. There are so many illusions attached to it. If we really see with extraordinary energy, then when the stimulus for that sort of sense indulgence presents itself again, we remain calm, unmoved. The reason why, what we call our passions and appetites and so on rise up again and again, is that we haven't really brought about a resolution once and for all. There is, of course, the tremendous force of all the glands and so forth against us. As long as those glands are powerful and active, they will continually throw up those stimuli. That is true. But if this sense of transcendence has awakened at all, then the power, the strength, not to resist, but to deal with them rightly, to respond rightly, to understand, also grows in us. And it canalizes that energy into right channels. See particularly how violence in the psyche blows up, explodes in reaction against sense frustration. It is a very interesting thing that where the Buddha emphasizes tanha so strongly, Sri Krishna attributed it all to krodha, anger, resentment, violence, violent reaction, krodha. The Buddha also emphasizes that aspect, you remember, getting free of the hindrances, as he calls them. The first one, which is the lust for this, that or the other, and the second is malevolence. Just let the mind see now that all this energy, misdirected, misspent, so hurtful to ourselves because of its unfortunate, infelicitous expressions, can, through understanding, insight, vision, be allowed to flow in the right way, which means the way of our redemption through the activity of transcendence. The great archetypal forces can heal. And when that happens, prithvi, earth, antariksha, the mid-region, psyche, and vyoman, heaven, mind in its own realm, pure mind, are in one great harmony, embodied in that psychophysical organism which bears our own name. let the mind also see quite clearly that this can never be regarded purely, solely as a personal salvation, an isolated salvation. It has no meaning whatsoever. All this argument about the Arahant and Bodhisattva ideal is so much talk. You cannot be an Arahant and be an isolated being, an ego, egoistic being. Cannot. Nirvana is devoid of ego.